You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, hi everybody. So if I can ask you please to come back to your seats, we're ready to continue with the last portion of our program, a really exciting portion of our program, because we get to share the conversation with female leaders in Japan. So let me tell you a little bit about what is the objective of this roundtable, and it's precisely to take on, to tackle the question of the leadership gender gap that was already raised in the previous session. And I think what we want to discuss today is why is it so difficult for women in Japan to achieve positions of authority, positions of leadership in a way in which it becomes more of an institutional trajectory and others can come behind them. I think we also want to understand what is the importance of having female role models. What are the consequences, the benefits of having more women in these positions of authority? And what have been the obstacles for that and how can we correct them? So I feel truly humbled to be sharing the stage today with this group of remarkable Japanese leaders. I'm going to be very brief in making the introductions, but I have to say that they have accomplished so much that I cannot be too brief. There's a lot that I want to bring to your attention, even though we actually provide the bios and you can read the full biography there. But let me start with Ms. Yoriko Kawaguchi, who has twice served in a cabinet position. She was the Minister of the Environment between 2000 and 2002, and Minister of Foreign Affairs between 2002 and 2004. She also served as a special advisor to the Prime Minister on Foreign Affairs and was later on elected to the House of Councillors, which is the upper house of the Japanese Parliament, where she chaired the Standing Committee on the Environment. Mrs. Kawaguchi is a former economist at the World Bank. She also has held the position of Minister at the Embassy of Japan here in D.C., and has co-chaired the International Commission on Nuclear Nonproliferation and Disarmament. She is a recipient of the Wilbur Cross Medal, which is a Yale University Award for Distinguished Public Service. Ms. Kawaguchi has a master's from Yale University and a BA from the University of Tokyo. Next, I would like to introduce Ms. Yukako Uchinaga, who is the founder and board chair of JWIN, Japan's Women's Innovative Network, which is a nonprofit organization that promotes diversity management in corporate business strategy. Until recently, she served as chairman of the board, chief executive officer, and president of Berlitz Corporation, and director and executive vice president of Benes Holdings. It is quite a remarkable long list of very senior positions. And I have to say that the one thing that blew me away from Uchinaga-san's biography is that she earned a degree in theoretical physics from the University of Tokyo. And after that, she joined IBM, where she rose the corporate ladder and became the first woman ever appointed to the board of a major computer company in Japan. Ms. Uchinaga has also served in the board of other companies, such as Sony and Aeon. And she was also the first non-American woman inducted in the Women in Technology International Hall of Fame. And she is also now a member of the Council for Gender Equality, a cabinet office in Japan, in the cabinet office in Japan. Next, I want to introduce Ms. Junko Chano, who is the executive director for programs at the Sasakawa Peace Foundation and president of the Sasakawa Peace Foundation USA, an organization devoted to the U.S.-Japan relations. And before joining the Sasakawa Foundation, Ms. Chano worked for the Ford Foundation and the Japan Foundation. Ms. Chano has a master's from the University of Pennsylvania, and she did her undergraduate studies at Hitotsubashi University. And also now I want to introduce Ms. Aiko Doden, who is senior news commentator at NHK, Japan Broadcasting Corporation. And she anchors there a debate program in English called Asian Voices that covers a wide range of issues. You could describe it everything from heart security to human security. Ms. Doden is very well known to Japanese audiences because she has also anchored leading news programs in Japan, such as NHK Good Morning Japan. She has been a correspondent in Thailand and is an expert in Myanmar, having traveled to that country as a journalist for over 40 times. And Mizorin has a master's from Columbia University and a bachelor degree from Sophia University. So you can see why I feel quite humbled to be here with all of you. So this is what we're going to do. First, I'm going to ask some general questions and engage the panelists so that we have a free-flowing conversation, and then we'll open it up for to invite you to join into this discussion. So I guess, first of all, I would like to hear about your personal experiences, if we may, about how you actually broke the glass ceiling. Now that you have achieved these tremendous positions of leadership with so many accomplishments, if you could look back and identify what you think were the critical, crucial ingredients for you to accomplish what we know is certainly not easy in Japan. So maybe we'll go in this direction, and then from then on, there will not be any specific order. So Uchinaga-san?
Oh. So the first question you asked me about what is the success factors to make the career up in IBM and also in the Berits and so on and so on. So for me, the hardest glass ceiling was the Japanese old boys network. This is a very difficult monoculture, and also especially in Japan, so a men's network is a very strong monoculture and also the very high context communication way. So in that situation, I am not such kind of the type of the person as the as already introduced. My background was the theoretical physics, and I prefer the low context communication. So then that was a very difficult barrier for me. And also another barrier for me was the no role models in IBM Japan. So these are the two big issues for me. And then how can I break through these kind of things? Is number one is the IBM Corporation. IBM Corporation made a very clear strategic decision to promote women in order to change the company cultures. So to be innovative company, the Lugasna decided to implement diversity. So that's a very strong help to me to break through these kind of things. And also another one is I have many mentors, and not only in IBM Japan, but also in a worldwide IBM. So mentors always gave me the many advice and also encouragement and also the new way of thinking. Especially one mentor, he gave me the vision of my careers. So until that, I did not realize the opportunity of my careers. But he gave me this kind of the great advice, and I was thinking the opportunity to growing up the higher position, higher and higher and higher position. So that was a very big opportunity for me to change my mind. And third one is the women's network, because as I said, no role models, and not only mentors, but also in the worldwide, IBM has many women executives. So then the many women executives make the networking, and we sharing the many good practices, and also that talking the some difficulties and encouraging each other. That's also gave me the very strong energy to challenge these kind of the obstacles. So that's mine.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. And Dodi-san.
Well, I feel rather intimidated sitting amongst the stellar panelists today. And I said yes to Mireya-san's offer because you had agreed to wake up so early in the morning to appear on my program. So, well, thank you very much for the invitation. No, I might be defined as a typical salaryman or a salary woman who have stayed with one company throughout one's career. So there is really no secret, but one has had to stay with the same organization to break the glass ceiling in order to bring about change, however small it might be. Former Secretary Clinton had once said that spoke of creating a small crack in the glass ceiling. Even making a small crack requires time and work. And I am among the first generation of equal employment law. And for many women in this generation, building a career meant staying in the race. They were constantly compelled to prove that women were equally competent or even better than our men colleagues. This meant that the women most often could not afford to have a break for fear of falling behind, because falling behind might set a very bad negative precedent for the younger generation that might want to follow our path. This also meant that the women who are seen as being successful has to be ready to make sort of sacrifices in life, often neglecting the ideal work-life balance in life without choice. And this also meant that the woman who chose a professional career had to excel in everything, virtually everything. And I hate to say this, but the women who are successful in the working environment are often labeled as superwomen, mm-hmm. Compelled to succeed all the time. While I also hate to say this, but I don't think I see so many supermen around in the working environment. But that's the reality, I think.
Thank you so much.
Kawai, would you say?
Thank you. This question of glass ceiling is a very difficult question to answer, because I personally do not remember hitting any glass ceiling. Mrs. Muraki, the person who spoke today, she became vice minister and second one in our bureaucracy's history. I started out as a bureaucrat. I did not become vice minister. Was it because of glass ceiling? My answer to that is no. The personnel, whoever decided that I cannot be vice minister, I think made a fair judgment. There were many competitors, and I just didn't make it. And I don't think I was even on a short list. Very fair to myself. That's the sense I get. And instead, I was helped by the Japanese system of seniority system and lifetime employment system, at least up to a certain point. That is until I left ministry. In the Japanese bureaucracy, the entrance is by examination. So if you pass that examination, then you become a bureaucrat. And no one judges you whether you can be a bureaucrat on the basis of whether you are a woman or not, or a man. And once you enter, then you are promoted, because there is a seniority system, and the years that you work in the ministry counts. So as the year went by, with or without any specific talent or ability, you get up to that position. And I feel that I was helped by that system. And so I just don't think I encountered, excuse me, any glass ceiling nor a bamboo ceiling. I just went on as system made it possible. Mm. So that's my answer to it.
Thank you very much. Very interesting. Chan-chan?
Well, thank you very much. And I'd like to echo what Miria said, that I also feel intimidated by just surrounded by such a splendid women. And also the difference between me and also the rest of the people is that they have a very big corporations or organizations or government organizations in their back. And I come from a philanthropic world, and my foundation, although I have two foundations to speak about, but both of these foundations are relatively small, although the Saskar Peace Foundation is one of the biggest in terms of the budget size and also in terms of the number of employees. But still, you know, it's far smaller than the organization that those splendid women are working or have worked for. Having said that, my short answer to your question is three things. One is to develop expertise in your field and stay committed to your mission. And second, be optimistic. And third, stand up and fight if it is necessary. So these are my short answers. And I'm saying this, and also, as I told you, that my organization, my foundation is relatively small, and that means that we can have some flexible, arrangements for, employees' work hours and something. So in that sense, in my case, I might say that it might be relatively easier for me to break, if there is a ceiling, break something. And I don't think, I'm not sure if this was a ceiling, but only once I faced some difficulty that I did have to overcome. And that was in 2003, when I came back from the United States to Japan after having worked at Ford Foundation's New York office for 7 years. And I was really felt responsible, and I was a little naive at that time, I think, that I really wanted to share with my colleagues at the Saskar Peace Foundation what I had learned at the Ford Foundation. And all of you know that it was one of the largest and also most active institutions, philanthropic institutions in the world. So I really wanted to share, and I ended up suggesting changes, but my bosses were not very comfortable with these changes that I was suggesting. And I think it is not because I was a woman, but maybe their resistance could have been increased by the fact that I was a woman and also challenging the system that is, all male dominated. So in that sense, sort of maybe not the ceiling, but I faced a kind of plastic, wall just in front of me. So, it was really a tough time for me, and sometimes I didn't know what to do, but I really still felt committed to share my knowledge and experiences. So, and sometimes I was vocal at these changes that could be necessary for the foundation. So finally, there was an incoming new chairman, and I took my case to him. So I helped him reorganize the foundation. So, I came back to Japan in 2003, and in 2008, I was named the executive director. So it is a very small, my experience, and I'm not sure if it is relative to, what you have experienced in your larger organizations.
Thank you so much. Really fascinating. So let me ask this question. How can we increase the visibility of female leaders? And the reason I ask is that there's a very frequent remark that comes up, and I guess there's a lot of truth to that, that some people go to Japan and they join these high-level meetings, and they frequently remark on the fact that there are very few or there's no women in the room, right? Then they come and ask, where are the female leaders of Japan? And I think that one of the reasons why I wanted to have this event here in D.C. is to showcase all of you, and to, make it very clear that Japan has these very talented, dynamic, creative women, and that, we should pay attention to what they're doing. And I wonder, what are your thoughts as to how we extend this spotlight and bring it into Japan as well? And I think that part of that goes to the question of, you put the spotlight on female leaders, but you also make sure that these leaders can leave a legacy by mentoring others. So it's the visibility, it is the mentoring, and I think this very much related to what Ms. Uchinaga was saying before, the networking. So how we make it that it's not just the old boys network, how we actually create this opportunity to rise together so that it's not just one token woman who is in the meeting. And I think that happens to all of us here in the United States as well. Frequently, I'm the only woman in the room. And I have a very strong desire to see that change. So any thoughts on this issue?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think this is the very important actions in order to increase the women's leaders in Japan, but actually this was very difficult. And then after I retired from IBM, by getting help from IBM headquarters, I started a nonprofit organization, which we call the Japan Women's Innovative Network. It stands JWIN. We call JWIN. The JWIN's objective is to create women's network of the Japanese company. So this non-profit organization membership is a Japanese company. And the company select the future women's leaders. And each company select two women. And going up to about 260 women from the 100 Japanese company, they are now meeting together for the, and also they are now making some proposal, and they are making some actions. And this kind of the networking activity, we continue 2 years. And then during this kind of the activity, they are understanding each other. And all of the 100 Japanese company are coming from the many different industries. So then they know each other. They're stimulating their activity and so on and so on. So JWIN is the purpose to educate the women's leader to be a next leader of the Japanese company. And also after 2 years, these women, we call the graduate. And then the new candidates are also selected by the company. So then we continue these kind of activity 4 times. And then at the graduated women and also the actual networking women is going up to the 1,000. So 1,000 young women's leaders is now making a very strong networking. So this is, I think, this is a very small activity, but that kind of the activity is now helping the women to change their mind, and also they have opportunity to use this kind of the networking for their own business. So one of the example is that when they join this network, their mentality to be a top leaders. We ask them, do you want to be a leader in your company? And about the less than 40% of women said yes. But after 2 years, 96% of the women say yes. Mm-hmm. So I think just only 2 years, we can change their mentality, and also we can change their passions and also their confidence. I think this is a very important activity. I really want to continue these kind of things as my give back to the young women, which I got from the IBM. Yeah.
I also think that encouraging young women and tell them what to do under various circumstances is also very, very important. About 20 years ago, 8 of us got together in Japan. Were you part of it?
8 years ago?
Leadership 111.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. I'm also the member.
8 of us got together. We initiated a group called Leadership 111, 111. The idea was that we get 111 members, potential female leaders, and then we that meeting still goes on, and we invite someone to speak to us, and then we discuss. Sometimes we have fun, and we get very close to each other. We can ask questions to each other, and that was one of the efforts that we were making, and we still are making in Japan, so that people feel more confident, develop ability to make right decisions, etc. Whatever is, there are many elements that a leader must have, and female or male. And you have to foster women who can make right judgments under a variety of circumstances. And also, you should be able to make your followers to do what you would like them to do. I remember just feeling that I don't mind working late hours for that person. I would do whatever that person tells me because I like him, I respect him, I think he's a good leader. To create, to make women like that so that there would be good followers, male or female, is our goal, I think.
If I could quickly follow up on some of the things that are being already said, I feel it crucial that there's got to be an institutional change to be brought about. Some of the points were raised in our previous session too. Having a like star figure parachuting into an organization or having a special promotion as a one-time thing just wouldn't do. I think it is more crucial to have a critical mass of competent women in the labor force who would propel the change that might transform the institution as well as the society, perhaps.
Yeah, I think that's, we have to create a pipeline. Mm-hmm. So not just only one or two star managers.
Right.
And we have to create a pipeline. The pipeline is also helping to each other's and mentoring each other's. That kind of things is very important.
Because each and every one of us cannot afford to be superwoman all the time.
Yes. So it's interesting because many, you know, all of you are talking about some extensive network and also some of the mentoring beyond corporations and beyond the field. And in my case, you know, in my foundation, we have female workers outnumber men by 2-to-1 ratio. Mm-hmm. And it is quite natural for them to see me as an example of how to develop your career and also how to keep your work and family thing. So in that case, I feel myself to be to have to be a role model. Yeah. And also the time I spent with them inherently has a kind of mentoring element. And I really find it a vital part of my job. So this is something that I'm really trying to contribute to my workforce in my foundation.
Just so if I face some sort of problem in the future, the person to come to might be Chano-san. You see, I totally agree with you because I see the point in what you say about building a network. I also feel that building a sort of a coalition, a benign coalition within an organization is crucial. A coalition of like-minded men and women who could be your colleagues or mentors, who would help transform the organizational culture as well as the society in general.
Yeah, and also talking about networking, you know, when I saw my female staff members, many working mothers, they are pressed for time and they don't necessarily have time to go out and networking. So what I intentionally do is that when they have some projects going on, and if I know some person or some organizations that whose work is relevant to their work, I will go out and tell them, oh, why don't you go and talk to so and so? So by doing so, I'd like them to naturally, develop their, extend their network and try to get out and know some people outside. So that's what I'm doing.
And networking is a key word, I think, because if you try to launch a revolution, you could antagonize so many within the organization being considered as a sort of a threat.
Yes.
So establishing a benign coalition would be much more productive.
Wonderful. This brings me actually to the next question I wanted to ask all of you, because I think that we have been discussing what can women or men do to be agents of change. And I want to now switch a little bit and talk about institutional resistance, right? And I think what I would like to ask all of you is, how do you think we can persuade different organizations that it's to their own benefit to promote women, that they're not doing it as out of a PR opportunity, they're not doing just to look good and, you know, so that the image effect, but that actually doing so is going to actually result in improvement in their performance. I think I've read somewhere that corporations that hire more women have higher levels of profitability. Right. And I haven't seen that laid out. Why is that the case? Why would having more women would actually bring those benefits to corporations or to other organizations? How do you think we could make this argument?
Okay. I think that's the most important point in order to promote diversity in the company. The company itself wants to improve the financial numbers, and they would like to compete. They would like to be a number one position in worldwide. So in order to do this, they would like to utilize the capable resources more and more. But in case of the Japan, most of the resources is based on the monoculture environment. So in the monoculture environment, it's very tough to change the mindset. So they are now just to use the very good, successful history, and they just pick up the past good example. But right now, because of the internet and IT improvement, I think the world is now changing so quickly. So in order to be a number one in worldwide from the business point of view, the company has to innovate. Company has to change their business model day and night. So in order to do this, I think a monoculture environment, it's very tough to find out a new business model. That's why many companies is seriously thinking to utilize diversified resources. So especially in Japan, for maybe 10 years ago, the monoculture environment was a very strong weapon. But now the world is changing. So I think the women is just the first step. And to get a different mindset, a different, background and a different, careers. These kind of the mind is now breakthrough the monoculture and creating a very innovative mindset. And once they can utilize the women and they can utilize the foreigners and the young people and so on and so on. I think the women is the first step. It's not the final goal. So then, I think especially Japan, diversity will create a new way of the Japanese business society and also the process. So I think that's a very important strategic initiative.
Very, very interesting.
I quite agree with Uchinaga-san. Again, about 20 or 30 years ago, I was talking to Swiss ambassador to Japan, and he said, I asked her a question. Switzerland does not have many resources, and yet Switzerland is so rich, very high per capita income. I asked why. And he said, progress comes from outside. And he told me how Switzerland was able to get foreign people, foreigners from Germany, from many other places. And it just hit me, dawned on me, that in Japan, progress comes from women. So I have been saying that progress comes from women ever since. And as Uchinaga-san said, our society as a whole, whether that's gender issue or not, are facing a huge need to change. Unless we can reform Japan, unless we can change ourselves, our society now, we are not going to ride on the waves of the globalization. And therefore, changing, to be able to change, to be able to be more flexible as a society as a whole, is what Japan needs right now.
Yeah.
And it's women, as Uchinaga-san well put it. It's one part of the huge efforts that we have to make.
Very interesting.
Yeah, I agree that, you know, women is just a part of the change. And I think, you know, we need more changes from overseas and from resources from overseas. And that's, I think, quite right.
And it seems The women are actually propelling change. I took note of some of the products introduced by Ms. Sakamoto in her presentation, like some of these genius hair dryers which do not dehydrate your hair, retains the moisture and keeps the luster sort of. That was devised by women. Mm-hmm. Washing machines that use less electricity and less detergent, mm-hmm. that was also devised by women. Ideas do come from women, it seems. And the Developmental Bank of Japan established the Women's Entrepreneurial Business Model Competition as of last year after the March 11th earthquake and tsunami, out of realization that it is the time that Japan does have to make the most of Japan's talent in women and their ideas. So I think the realization is slowly but there.
Very interesting. So I have one more question for the panelists, and then I'll open up for the floor. And this has to do with the question of affirmative action. And you know that some countries have government-mandated quotas, and they say, you know, this is a percentage of women that are going to be represented in the board, and companies have to move along those lines. I know that in Japan you don't have those mandatory programs, but I wonder what is your general thought about the value of affirmative action programs that could work in the Japanese context. And I think that it was an excellent point that you all raised, that women is just the first step in making for a more diverse, plural workplace and society in Japan. But then this raises the question as to what should be the target group to begin with. Should it be women, or it should be just young people in general? So how do we reconcile these needs of, you know, giving perhaps priority to women, to give them special treatment, but then also look into the needs of other groups who may also need that kind of targeting? Hmm. How would you think this?
Affirmative action has been discussed, and it is something which has not gained any consent in our society. I think we need, it relates to the question of what is fair. Whom do I give the advantage when there are many disadvantaged people by age, by gender, by whatever? So that is something we need to continue to discuss. And another element we have to think about is that there are types of affirmative actions. I was a diet member until recently, and we were talking in the diet among my party members, female members, whether we should work to promote affirmative action or not. The conclusion we have at that point, which was quite recent, was, for some people, it's an absolute no. You have to be elected by your own merit. And if you people think that you are there in the diet because you are female, then you erode your power base. So that was one type of argument. Then we were looking at Korea's case, in which for the proportional representation, the number of candidates have to be equal between men and women. On that basis, you have an election, you choose people. Then that concern of eroding your power base becomes less because you are given the opportunity, equal opportunity, but then you are selected because you are good. So there are types of affirmative actions, and we are still in need of, I think, exploring what is good for Japan. And we certainly do need consensus of the society, is my sense.
Very interesting.
It may not be about the affirmative action, but I was quite impressed with what Sakamoto-san talked about the Métis initiative coming up with 100 corporations and good practices. And I think it's a very good way to do that. And I'd like to see more of somewhat grassroots initiatives that may go out and study major corporations or organizations about their maybe family friendliness or female friendliness or whatever, just using some of the common indicators, such as the ratio of male and female on the board of directors, or how many percent of women are on the managerial position, and also what kind of benefits they are offering for working parents or so and so. And if they come up with a study and then regularly publicize that kind of results, that might be an interesting impact on the society, and maybe it is helpful for women to look for more corporations that might provide greater opportunities for women, and also it might influence on the image of the companies, and it might also influence on the making decision, making a purchasing decision and something like that. So, I think affirmative action is one good thing to pursue. And another thing would be, and perhaps I'm from the philanthropic world, I'd like to see a kind of grassroots effort and, try to, educate the public and also on the same, in a sense, corporations about what they could be done for, that kind of things.
One small additional comment, perhaps. Mm-hmm. In a discussion like this, what I would like to keep in mind is that, of course, it is about womenomics and about economy and urbanomics, but women's participation, as many of you have said, is not just about women's issue, it's about men's issue as well. And it's not only an economy issue. I think I'd like to think it is a fundamental rights issue as well. Women's participation is not simply just about the boosting economy. It's about ensuring women do have the right to education and work, and that is how Japan prospered after the Second World War. The sort of aspect of Japan that is admired by many of the developing countries in Asia as well. And I am aware that Prime Minister Abe is going to be giving a speech at the United Nations General Assembly with a slight focus on women as well. So if Japan wants to articulate its foreign policy on values like human security, I feel that it has to impress upon the international community that it does care about women within Japan and beyond. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. Uchinaga-san, you had a comment?
Well, I completely agree, Chano-san.
Thank you.
Chano-san's point. And, I'm so sorry. I still believe that the diversity is a very, very strong strategic initiative for business. So then from that point, I think that many companies has to make a commitment in front of the shareholders. What kind of the number they would like to attain in their own company by when? So these kind of the company's commitment, like revenue and profit and also diversity, because this is a very important business initiatives in order to survive in this kind of the globalized environment. So in that situation, I think a company has to make declare what kind of the percentage the company will be, what kind of the women's percentage they would like to attain, what kind of the management women's percentage. So these kind of the number they have to declare in front of the shareholder. Mm-hmm. And they have to report the progress, like revenue and profit, so on and so on. And then once they do these kind of things, I think some kind of the affirmative action within the company is very important, because the minority got a very big handicapped because of this kind of the long history. So then I think some kind of the affirmative action is very important. But this affirmative action should be applied to the opportunity, not the final decisions. So then that education and career opportunity, these kind of things should be applied to the women's, and that will be the very important first step. So that is the same thing which the Kaguchi-san already mentioned.
Thank you very much. So now I would like to ask the audience to join the conversation, and please, if you want to ask a question, make a comment, raise your hand, and they identify yourself when the mic reaches you.
Hello. Hey. My name is Erin Weeks. Like my fellow colleague who was sitting here earlier, I am also from Slice across the street, and I taught in Japan for 3 years. And my comment deals with the educational issue. You've discussed corporation outreach and connecting women leaders within corporations, but what about women leaders connecting to educational institutions? Particularly, I was in a middle school, to the younger educational institutions, middle schools, high schools, and some of those efforts. Is there anything going on?
May I?
Yes, please.
Okay. So from the education point of view, in Japan, the men and women are treated equally, completely. But sometimes the girls or the women, they don't have enough, how do I say, enough future view about their careers. That is a very big barrier for the women to growing up the careers. So then, in our cases, we are now inviting that high school student, university student, and to talk with the women who are doing the very high careers in the business. So that kind of the communication we started. I think education itself is fairly equal. So we have to show the opportunity to them about opportunity of the women's careers. I think that's the most important point.
Excellent. Other questions? Nobody else? Paige? Oh, and then over there. Sorry. All right, so maybe this gentleman in the light blue shirt and glasses. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Dave Hoff. I'm retired, but I went to GW and participated in their PhD program. And at GW, they had a very nice program to bring college juniors, women, in. It was called Women in Mathematics. And they brought them in, and they had women mathematicians teach them a little bit about research. And a lot of them went on to graduate school because I think they got experience working with women mathematicians, very high level, and they sort of came to gain possession sort of being a mathematician, being a grad student. And so I think that was very successful. And just like you said, David.
Thank you. Thank you very much for that comment. And I think someone next to you wanted to ask a question. This lady there. Thank you.
I'm also a student at SAIS. My name is Tomoko and Ikeda. And my question was that, building on what the lady sitting over there was saying, that it's building on demand side. Mm-hmm. I think that there's still attitude that women still want to just get married to a typically like wealthy guy and just become a housewife, and sometimes it's like a dream. Do you think that that social attitude is decreasing? Because at my age still, some of my friends say, oh, I just want to get married and become a housewife. So do you think that the social aspect is
interesting question.
Gradually decreasing?
Thank you for your question. Yes, Chanu-san, you have a...
But I think in reality, I think the average salary of the business white collar workers has been decreasing in Japan. I think it was peaked somewhere in 1987 or something, if my memory is correct. So in that sense, your husband, if you get married, maybe your husband's salary is not increasing at all. And then social services, you cannot depend social services because of the declining population. So in reality, I think it's better for you to have double income family. I think this is think seriously, this is the truth in Japan. I'm not sure about the Wall Street guys because there was a discussion about difference in the salary. So maybe if you get married with the Wall Street nice guy, things might be different. But
there's limited supply, I think.
That's right.
But I do understand the mentality because I think the younger generation have seen their parents' generation suffer from the burst of the bubble economy and things like that. So they haven't seen Japanese economy grow. So the conclusion is that they'll be better off getting married to a wealthy man or something like that, and she's nodding. But at the same time, as Chano-san said, with the shrinking Japanese population, women sooner or later would no choice but to have to be in the labor force actively. And I think there is imperative for the private sectors to secure high-quality women labor force if they want to remain competitive. in the market.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Paige, you had a question?
Thank you. And it follows on to that last comment a bit. It was referenced earlier to developing global talent, and I heard about Uchinaga-san's suggestion about a strategy to promote diversity. And there are a number of us in the United States and Japan that are concerned about the declining numbers of Japanese youth in particular who are doing study abroad in the United States. And part of that third arrow that Prime Minister Abe has referenced is to try to develop global talent. And I can't help but observe the fact that the four of you in your distinguished careers have overseas experience, proficiency in at least one foreign language and probably a number of others. So I'm wondering the extent to which you think an overseas experience has been one of the things that helped you in your personal and professional success, and whether or not you can help us think about ways to encourage more Japanese youth. Because frankly, for those who do study abroad overseas, either Americans or Japanese, the majority are in fact women. And so I see an opportunity here. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any responses on that question? Yes?
Thank you very much. I think this is the very important areas we have to think about. And especially globalization is now asking us to be a global leaders more and more. And diversity is the very important capability which is required to be a global leader. So then, at least my experience, I don't have any experience to stay in outside of the Japan, but from my business point of view, I'm traveling a lot, and almost one-third of the year, I'm now visiting the many countries. So because of my experiences, I had many experience to be a global, how do you say, workers. So this is a very important factors, and also in Japan, the kind of the needs are now recognized and then increased. Yeah, you are right. And about 5 years ago, overseas student from Japan was decreasing significantly. But recent 1 and 2 years, from the year-to-year point of view, about 30%, 40% increasing. So the many young people now recognize the importance to go out from the Japan and to get the experience of the global business situations. So I think the situation in Japan is now changing so quickly. And also in case of the women, and if the women want to grow up their careers to get high positions, they have to show some confidence. And I think this is a great opportunity for women to go out to the foreign countries to have some global business experience and come back to Japan. So that might be a very convincing story for the Japanese company to give her the very high positions. So I think globalization, diversity, is a very good, how do I say, a movement for women to growing up their careers.
Thank you very much. Kawaguchi-san.
I have been talking about international competitiveness of an individual. And I think it is very important that we foster young people who are competitive globally. I was in America for 1 year when I was a high school student, and ever since I've been back and forth. But one thing I learned, perhaps the greatest thing I learned by being here in this country, is that there are many other ways of doing things other than what we do in Japan.
Right.
And so that gave me a variety, the diversity in thinking or way of doing things. Mm-hmm. And Japan will be globalized more. Already there are some companies who conduct their board meetings in English. So if you want to be promoted to the board level, you have to be able to do business in English. That's one incentive. You may be just producing a small part of something in Japan. You think you live without English all through your life, then all of a sudden you are assigned to a position abroad. Then you have to struggle with English or whatever. So life, as Uchinaga-san was saying, life is changing in Japan a great deal. And with that awareness that you have to be more global, each individual is. And my experience as a high school student here, long, long time ago, taught me that.
Thank you. Thank you so much. This has been a remarkable conversation. If you could please join me in thanking the panelists for joining us today.